Israeli forces attack Palestinian protesters in Beit El and Bethlehem amid widespread demonstrations across the West Bank. Israeli warplanes and artillery keep pounding the Gaza Strip as the Palestinian death toll tops 210, almost half of them women and children. Palestinian resistance forces target two Israeli settlements at a military post in retaliation for Israeli attacks on Gaza. Hi, everybody. This is World News with me, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian protesters who gathered in the occupied West Bank cities of Bethlehem and Beit El to condemn the regime's deadly aggression against the Gaza Strip. Regime forces fired tear gas to disperse the ralliers, who in turn hurled rocks and burned tires to express their anger. Thousands of people also took to the streets of the cities of Ramallah and Hebron, also known as Al-Khalil, in solidarity with Gaza. Clashes also erupted in Jerusalem Al-Quds, as well as the Al-Aqsa Mosque, with Israelis detaining a number of Palestinians. Meantime, a general strike is underway across the West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds against Israeli atrocities in the occupied territories and besieged Gaza. On Monday, the forces shot and killed two Palestinians during similar protests in the West Bank. Israel is pounding the Gaza Strip with fresh airstrikes and shelling from land and sea, as the deadly onslaught of the besieged Palestinian territory enters its second week. The latest attack hits residential buildings near the main hospital in the Gaza Strip and a site near the Islamic University in western Gaza. Israeli media say 65 targets in Gaza and Khan Yunus were hit within half an hour. The regime's artillery also shelled the eastern parts of the city of Rafah in southern Gaza Strip. The onslaught has killed 212 Gazans since it began last Monday. The dead include 61 children and 36 women. The indiscriminate bombing has also destroyed 800 buildings in Gaza and damaged 10,000 more structures. Now, in the meantime, Palestinian resistance groups have launched fresh attacks on Israel in retaliation for the deadly onslaught on Gaza. Israeli officials said that two people were killed in rocket attacks on the Eshkol region in southern Israel. This has raised a death toll in Israel to 12 since the beginning of the attacks. Hamas's military wing said earlier that it had targeted an Israeli military post east of Gaza with mortar shells. The Ezzedin al-Qassam brigades also fired missiles into the Israeli cities of Ukfim and Netivot. Before that, the group fired rockets into Sderot and hit a gathering of Israeli soldiers near the city. Other Israeli cities, including Ashkelon and Beersheba, as well as several military bases, were also targeted. In the past days, Palestinian rocket attacks also hit Tel Aviv. Resistance groups have promised more attacks there if Israel does not stop the air strikes on Gaza. Monster cyclone Tauktae has killed at least two dozen people in India. The cyclone has battered its waves up the vast nation, sending huge waves crashing onto its shores. It also turned streets into rivers, forcing hundreds of thousands of people to flee. Savage winds swept through flimsy homes and uprooted trees, as well as electricity pylons. Authorities in Mumbai have closed the city's airport, urging the people to stay indoors. Meanwhile, 96 people went missing after a vessel adrift off Mumbai's coast sank during the cyclone. That's the biggest to hit India in decades. The cyclone has interrupted the COVID vaccine program there. Munawwar Zaman says that a second COVID wave is yet to peak in India, and that despite the measures to curb the spread of the killer virus.
Well, the situation has somehow been under control over the last 3 or 4 days. What we say under control doesn't mean the COVID has started retreating, but yes, the number of active cases is dropping to a marginal level, but at the same time, the death toll is climbing. What we are talking about, these are those people who were already admitted in the hospitals in the different places, and that's the reason why we are seeing a phenomenal rise in the death toll, and this death toll is expected to rise further in the coming weeks. What we see in the change in trends, for example, the drop in cases, is because of the fact that the countries, many states of the countries, have announced their own measures, such as lockdowns and restrictions. That has helped the country to contain the spread to some extent. But let me tell you that this is not the peak. We are yet to wait. We are still waiting for second wave peak, which scientists believe is the month of August.
Now, in other news, Iran has reported more COVID infections and related deaths across the country in the past day. The health authorities say that 310 more people have succumbed to the disease, pushing the death toll to more than 77,500. Iran has been reporting less than 400 daily deaths for the past few days. Authorities logged some 14,000 new daily infections that raised the caseload to over 2.7 million. The government imposed restrictions last month following a steep rise in deaths and infections. Health experts blamed the UK variant, as well as people's failure to follow health protocols, for the rising cases. Okay, now it's time for the Iran election special coverage. Now let's see what the election news we got for you. Iran is set to hold a presidential election on June 18th to pick its successor to incumbent Hassan Rouhani. Last week saw many hopefuls register for the vote. Among them were Ebrahim Raisi. He's the current judiciary chief and an incumbent member of the Assembly of Experts. Now this next report takes a look at his profile and the post that he has held over the past years.
Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi is a prominent Iranian cleric who was born in 1960. He has held several key posts in the judiciary branch since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, serving as the prosecutor of the cities of Karaj and Hamadan, as well as the capital Tehran. In 1994, Raisi was appointed as the head of General Inspection Office. He also served as first Deputy Chief of Justice of Iran and the Attorney General of the country. In March 2016, Raisi became the chairman of Astan Quds Razavi. That's an umbrella administrative organization managing the holy shrine of the 8th Shia Imam in Mashhad and several other institutions. In March 2019, Raisi was appointed as the Judiciary Chief, a post he currently serves. Raisi is also an incumbent member of the Assembly of Experts. He has now announced that he will join the race for the June presidential election in Iran. Raisi registered for the election on May 15th and said he's running as an independent under the slogan of fighting corruption.
I see myself as the rival to corruption, inefficiency and aristocracy. I'm not a rival to political factions and this or that group. I'm the rival of inefficiency.
Raisi says he wants to participate in the presidential poll because of public demand and has pledged change in managing the country's affairs. Raisi ran for president in the previous election in 2017 when he gained 38% of the vote. He ranked second behind incumbent president Hassan Rouhani.
Now next, Iran's first vice president, Saleh Jahangiri, is another presidential hopeful who was a member of parliament for 8 years and served as cabinet minister for 2 terms. Jahangiri was a candidate in the 2017 presidential vote, but he withdrew in favor of incumbent Hassan Rouhani. The next report takes a closer look at his profile.
Eshaq Jahangiri was born in 1958 in Kerman. He holds a PhD in industrial management. Jahangiri began his political career following the 1979 revolution. He became the deputy head of the agriculture department in Kerman in 1980 and was appointed as its head 2 years later. Jahangiri has also served as a member of parliament for 8 years. He was appointed as the governor of Isfahan Iran in September 1992 by then-President Akbar Hoshemi Rafsanjani and held the position until 1997 when he was nominated by then-President Mohammad Khatami as the Minister of Mines and Metals and was confirmed by the Parliament. His portfolio was later changed to the Minister of Industries and Mines. Jahangiri is the co-founder of Executive Construction Party and served as its Secretary General from 2006 to 2010. In 2013, after Hassan Rouhani won the presidential election, Jahangiri was appointed as the first vice president. He was nominated for the 2017 presidential election, but withdrew in the final days of campaigning and endorsed Rouhani. Later, after Rouhani won the election, Jahangiri was reappointed as first vice president. On May 15, Jahangiri registered to run for president. He called for a huge turnout in the vote to overcome the problems the country is facing.
Iran has been facing hardship in many areas during the past few years. It needs to open new horizons in people's lives. We need to expand the country's capabilities in all aspects. We need to improve the people's lives by removing the sanctions and achieving a stable economic growth and fair distribution of wealth. The elections have to be considered an opportunity based on the Islamic Revolution's values. The presidential election is around the corner. An election for everyone to take part.
The first vice president described his ideal government as an entity at the service of the people. He said a practical government should respond to people's demands and act transparently. As a president, Jahangiri said he would pick honest people for his cabinet and resolutely fight any forms of corruption inside his administration.
A former Iranian nuclear negotiator, Saeed Jalili, is among hopefuls running for president in the country's June 18th election. Jalili served in different posts since the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. He has served as the Deputy Foreign Minister and also Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council. Jalili is now a member of the Expediency Council. The next report takes a look at his background.
Saeed Jalili was born in 1965 in the Iranian city of Mashhad. He holds a PhD in political sciences. Jalili is a veteran of the Iraqi-imposed war in the 1980s. He was severely injured in battle and lost the lower part of his right leg. In 1989, Jalili joined the Foreign Ministry. There, he served as the director of the inspection office from 1995 to 1996. 5 years later, he became a senior advisor to leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Jalili became a member of the Supreme National Security Council in 2002. 3 years later, he was appointed as the Deputy Foreign Minister for European and American Affairs. Jalili served in that post for 2 years. In 2007, he replaced Ali Larijani as the Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council and was put in charge of international negotiations on Iran's nuclear program. Jalili's term ended in September 2013 when Ali Shamkhani took over. Immediately after leaving the SNSC, Jalili became a member of the Expediency Council under a decree by Ayatollah Khamenei. Jalili ran as a member of parliament for Mashhad twice, in 2004 and 2008, but lost in both elections. He also ran for president in 2013 when he received over 4 million votes and ranked third. Now he has decided to run for the post again and signed up in May this year for the June presidential election.
Today, some issues are important for people. Those issues include sanctions, inflation, and unemployment. The future president should provide practical solutions to these problems and avoid rhetoric.
Jalili is critical of the current administration when it comes to resolve economic problems. He believes it is a wrong approach to only focus on the sanctions removal in order for economic prosperity to happen. Instead, Jalili says sanctions should be bypassed while focus is put on domestic capabilities.
Okay, now let's see who's next. Ali Larijani has served in several key positions since the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. He was the head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting Organization for 10 years, and then it became parliament speaker and served there for 12 years. Larijani ran unsuccessfully in the 2005 presidential vote. Now he has decided to make another attempt and see if he could be picked as the top executive post. Let's take a look at his profile.
Ali Larijani was born in 1957. He holds a bachelor's degree in computer science and mathematics and a PhD in Western philosophy. He began his political career following Iran's Islamic Revolution and has served in a number of posts, including Deputy Minister of Information and Communications Technology, as well as Deputy Minister of Labor and Social Affairs. In March 1994, he was appointed as the head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. He was in office until July 2004. In the same year, he became an advisor to leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. In 2005, he was appointed as secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. Larijani was elected to represent the city of Qom in the March 2008 parliamentary vote and was subsequently named as Speaker of Iranian Parliament. He retained the seat in the next two parliamentary elections as well and kept his post as Parliament Speaker until 2020. Larijani took part in the presidential election in 2005, where he ranked sixth, winning nearly 6% of the ballots cast. In May 2021, he announced a second bid for the executive post.
What made me determined in recent days to register was that I felt Iran is in such a state that those who have come forward are not capable of solving the country's main economic problem.
Larijani called for more solidarity and unity within the country and demanded better relations with Western countries and a stronger ties with Iran's allies.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
What is happening among Palestinians today is part of what is happening in Al-Quds and Gaza and is a continuation of what happened on Land Day in 1976 after the Sabra and Shatila massacre in 1982 during the Second Intifada, says Abir Kopti, author, in an article titled "From North to South, Palestinians are fighting to reclaim their voice." Stay tuned for more. When Palestinians took part in the Second Intifada and protested in their towns and villages, the narrative was that they were protesting the discrimination they faced in the occupied Palestine as citizens, as opposed to being part of the uprising against the occupation. This was because these protests came a few years after the signing of the Oslo Accords, which told Palestinian citizens that they were no longer a part of the Palestinian liberation cause. This narrative was echoed by the Palestinian leadership and the international community, who refused to look at issues from institutional discrimination to racism and apartheid as an integral part of the Israeli settler colonial regime. Their problems were framed as civil rights issues,
no one was interested in listening to the narrative of liberation. Today, Palestinians are rising up in Aqqa, Lid, Ramla, Nazareth, Haifa, and dozens of other Palestinian cities and villages across historic Palestine, sending a simple but powerful message. We are all united for one cause, and all attempts to divide us have failed. While it might be more comfortable for some to think of Aqqa or Lid in a context separate from Al-Quds or Al-Khalil, all are subjected to the Zionist regime's colonial project, which might differ in technicalities, but not in its supreme goal to maintain a Jewish majority and superiority over Palestinians. In other words, the goal is to colonize Palestinian lands and drive Palestinians out. The recent Human Rights Watch HRW report, A Threshold Crossed, Israeli authorities and the crimes of apartheid and persecution is important not just for its content, but also for its approach. Finally, human rights advocates are addressing the various policies affecting all the different parts of Palestine. HRW points to several policies inside the occupied Palestine that are essentially no different from what is happening in Sheikh Jarrah, Al-Quds, or other areas of the occupied West Bank, noting that Israeli regime authorities methodically privilege Jewish Israelis and discriminate against Palestinians. Palestinian citizens of occupied Palestine, who comprise 19% of the population, reside on just 3% of the land. Palestinians lost most of their land after 1948 Nakba due to confiscation and displacement by the Israeli regime. An estimated 200,000 Palestinians are internally displaced, meaning they might live a few kilometers from their original villages, but the Israeli regime continues to deny their right to return, as it does to millions of Palestinian refugees. As HRW notes, many Palestinian towns and villages are surrounded by land designated for purposes such as security zones, Jewish regional councils, national parks, and nature reserves or highways, which prevent or impede the possibility of their expansion in the future. Around 90,000 Palestinian Bedouins in Nagab live under constant threat of displacement, residing in nearly 40 unrecognized communities that are denied access to education, health services, electricity, and sewage systems. One such village, Al-Aqrib, has been demolished by the Israeli regime 185 times, while tens of thousands of homes in Palestinian towns and villages are at risk of demolition because they lack building permits. Palestinians in mixed cities such as Lid, Aqqa, Jaffa, and Ramla have been subjected to ethnic cleansing, Judaization, and the erasure of their Palestinian identity. The village of Damash between Lid and Ramla is another Sheikh Jarrah. Its approximately 1,000 Palestinian residents have been fighting against the threat of displacement for two decades. Two Palestinians in Damash were martyred, having no shelters to run to when sirens alerted them of an incoming strike. If these were not enough, reasons to be angry, the Zionist regime has also developed other direct and indirect strategies of suffocation to make life for Palestinians unbearable. More than a third of Palestinians live in poverty due to decades of Zionist regime negligence and budgetary discrimination, imposed socioeconomic and security challenges, including high poverty and unemployment, aim to drain Palestinians and keep them too busy to address the broader context. Yet one should not underestimate the power of people to rise up in times of despair. What is happening among Palestinians today is part of what is happening in Al-Quds and Gaza, and is a continuation of what happened on Land Day in 1976, after the Sabra and Shatila massacre in 1982, during the Second Intifada, and during the Stop Power Plan campaign in 2013. This is the culmination of a struggle for freedom, dignity, justice, and the right to return to their lands. If people are deprived of power and of a voice for decades, they will sooner or later rise up to reclaim it. Now is the time to try to understand this anger, rather than telling people to stay calm and endure further injustices.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And to help us with our questions, we have with us the dear Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for coming to our program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure being here.
Thank you very much. So we're continuing a discussion we had together last time. It was on this question. I'm a mother who is constantly shouted at and beaten up by my husband. And unfortunately, my son witnesses a lot of these unhappy events. I'm worried about his psychological well-being, and I have no idea how to help him. Last time we met, Sayyid, you said that first of all, the parent who is being abused, who could be male or female, should realize that no one is allowed to violate their rights. So step one would be for them to ask someone to help them get over this kind of domestic abuse. Step two would be to sit down with the child and discuss it with them, because they understand, and spoiling them with ice cream and gaming consoles and all of that isn't going to fix the problem. It's going to bury it, but then it can all burst out into anxiety, depression, and all sorts of psychological issues. So that's what the parent who is being abused should do in regards to the child. But this family is also a member of the community, perhaps a Muslim community. What we want to discuss today is what can the community do for this child who is unfortunately witness to this kind of abuse.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. There's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi where he says, "You are all responsible for earth and that and those who dwell on earth." There's a sense of responsibility on all of us to show love and compassion towards our fellow human beings. So you can't say, well, I'll just mind my own business. I'll just take care of my own family, and whatever happens to the rest is not my problem. That's not an Islamic notion, because in Islam says you're all in one family. The hadith, the famous hadith from the Prophet, like you're all on one body, right? It's like a body that if one part of the body starts to feel pain, the rest of the body would feel the pain as well. So as Muslims, this is how we should be. As a humanity in general, this is how we should be, at least. We should feel the pain of one another. So if we see that there is a problem in our community or with our neighbors, it is our responsibility, our duty to step in and offer support and help. The first, even when it comes to the community itself and our role, the first thing we need to do in to trying to help those who are going through violence is first we need to bring an awareness to the issue. Because you will realize and you will see that most of the times in our communities, such topic is tabooed. It's like they don't, like you don't see people talking about it publicly or trying to get to the, you know, details of it. They just brush it off for this sense of moral value things like, oh, you should not, for example, hit someone else and that's it. That's where the, what ends. Or you should not shout and that's where it ends. Or you need to be good to your spouse and that's where it ends. That's just a brushing of the topic, but sometimes you need to get to the bottom of things and make people really aware of the severity of the situation and the problem itself. So that would be our first goal into trying to help other people who are in this problem or who are facing this issue.
All right, thanks. We're going to take a break now, and we'll be back after the break for the rest of the discussion.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about domestic abuse. And if there's a family in our community that is experiencing that kind of abuse, one of the partners or perhaps a child, we're asking what the community has to do about it. So before the break, we said that, first of all, I actually like that response because it's a precaution. It's teach the community about the negative effects of domestic abuse. Once you do that, you've already solved problems before they even arise. Mm-hmm. Now we have a family that is experiencing domestic abuse. What should the community do in regard to the child?
Okay, so after having that kind of awareness in the community about this issue, which is a prevention measure like you said, the community need to establish services for those who might go through domestic violence, right? So, for example, if that person in question is going through domestic violence, if there are services available in their community for them, they know what to go, who to talk to, right? They wouldn't be stuck in their houses and that abuse will continue. For example, if there's a center, if there's a mosque, for example, if there's a person appointed by the community to deal with these issues, that person who suffers abuse, they know exactly where to go. So we need to provide services for them. And you'll see that mainly in the West, this kind of thing is always there. They have different sort of services for domestic abuse and domestic violence. And sometimes even most families back in the West, they would resort to the police. That's the first, their first option. Like they would call the police and say, well, you know, I'm under this and that, and then the police will show up and they would take care of the case. In our countries or some in Islamic countries, maybe that's not the case. You could call the police and the police would be helpless to do anything, to say the least, because some of them, they either run by culture or some of them either run by religion, religiously governed. So, for example, if it's a religiously governed country, we usually don't allow any other person to interfere with my own problems with my wife, for example. Like I said, this is my personal life. It's got nothing to do with you, right? So sometimes the force of law doesn't have much to do. So therefore, we need to have these kind of services, for example, to have people appointed in our communities, either dedicated centers or either dedicated personnel who work in mosques and centers in Husseiniyah or whatever you whatever have you in your own neighborhood, what they can turn to for help. Because if they don't have that connection, that mean of help, they will obviously feel helpless, and either the domestic abuse will continue, or either, God forbid, it will lead to something that, you know,
it's even worse.
Even worse, like we don't want to be in. Either, for example, you would have a reaction where the woman might take things into her own hands, or she might get the authorities involved, and especially if you're a Muslim in a Western country and you get the authorities involved, they will take your kids. So there's child protection and child services, and the first thing they do is they remove the child from this environment. So you lose your child altogether. So either being, you know, either in the West or even in an Islamic country, we need to have that establishment of services where those who could go through these issues, they could come to help or ask for help.
That's very essential. So if you're out there, step one, create awareness. Step two, try to provide the community with a person that they can trust and go to in times of trouble and distress. Thank you very much. We're going to have to take a break now.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, where we try to answer the questions regarding the Islamic upbringing of our children. In the last two episodes, we've been talking about domestic violence, the negative effects of domestic violence. In this program, we've been talking about the role that a community can play to prevent domestic violence and to help the children who are subject to this kind of issues. So first thing you said was to raise awareness and solve the problem before it even arises. A parent who knows and understands the negative effects of domestic violence will probably not get himself into it. Second is to help the community establish services where members can visit when they are in trouble and they need help. Let's imagine that I'm in a community where that's not possible. The community won't support that kind of establishment, or the government won't let me, or I'm not the kind of guy who can organize such a thing. As an individual, how can I help a child who is subject to some sort of domestic violence?
All right, so you're talking as a stranger from outside or as a person who is related to the child?
Not necessarily related by blood, but from the same community. We know each other.
So if you know a person who is going through abuse or domestic violence is happening in their houses, then obviously you have the, as we call it, a duty of care. You need to show your support. Sometimes, most of us, we've been through this in a way or another, depends on the level of the situation that we faced. There are times where the only thing we need is to have someone just to listen to us, right? You feel that you got a lot of things in your mind, you just want to express, and you just want someone to listen to you, be there for you, show you that kind of support. So if you're a friend, or if you're a community member, and you know someone is going through domestic violence, because sometimes we get to see it, we get to hear it, and news travels quicker these days. It's just a matter of just showing your support. Just going there, saying hello, going for a walk, I don't know, going for a coffee, and speaking to that person, trying to comfort them, trying to get them to talk, and just make them feel that there is someone that's out there to help them out, to support them, to listen to their problems. So that in itself, it might seem to be very simple, but in fact, it's a lot to the person who's going through the abuse. For example, in the same way that you go to a psychologist or a therapist, all you do is you just sit there and talk, and someone just listens to you, a stranger listens to you. And most of the times, therapists or psychologists, they don't say much, right? They might ask you like tiny, small questions, and the rest you do the rest of yourself. But as you leave, you feel that source of comfort. You feel a bit of relief. You feel that the burden on your shoulders have been taken out. So just a matter of talking itself relieves a person. Like they say, Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayh, he used to go outside to the desert and he used to put his head in a well and he used to talk. He just get things out of his chest.
Yeah.
So this is as simple as it is. So if you know someone who's going through such an issue, just talk to them nicely, kindly. Try to bring them in, be their friend, give them that mental support that they might, you know, be in need of.
And that's something you can do, and you can be sure that you can't go wrong with it. Because my next question was going to be, some people might refrain from that kind of activity, worrying that they might make things worse. They might give bad advice, for instance.
That is true. This actually happens because a lot, especially with, because see, what we're dealing with here is a mental problem, right? If someone's going through abuse, it's a mental problem, it's a disease, right? It's a sickness. So you can't, in the same way that if you have a disease, you can't just take any medication. You need to take the right medication. So if you see someone going through mental, through family violence in his house, so obviously he's diseased, he's sick, so he needs a proper help. So the first thing you should do is actually educate yourself. Go read of how to deal with a person in or who's going through family violence or domestic violence. And you will find clear instructions of how to talk to them, how to deal with them, what kind of question you should avoid, what kind of words you should avoid, because there are certain things that might trigger that person instead of making them come to you, make them run away from you. So the first thing you need to do is educate yourself before you can help someone.
All right, thank you very much. In this episode, we talked about domestic violence, about what the family can do and what the community can do about it. If you missed our program, don't worry, you can always download an archive of this episode and previous ones from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com, click on Call of Islam Radio, and you can find our program Islamic Upbringing right there. You can also visit our social media accounts. Simply search Call of Islam Radio on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and Telegram. Until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
There is a vacuum in the UK's response to decades of the Israeli regime's land annexation, settlement building, and human rights abuses against Palestinians, says Alan Duncan Ryder in an article titled UK Government Has a Moral Blind Spot Over Plight of Palestinians. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Zionist regime wants to take territory which does not belong to it, and all of the claims and counterclaims about the rights and wrongs on either side stem from this single fundamental fact. In 1948, following a vicious conflict between June and September, 700,000 Palestinians were forced out of their homes.
Today, contrary to the express guarantee contained in the Balfour Declaration of 1917, the rights of the non-Jews, the Palestinians, have not been protected. Palestinians are stateless, their land is occupied by the Israelis, and Palestine itself is perhaps the only populous territory in the world that rests unattached to any named state and is not permitted to call itself one. International law is absolutely clear that the West Bank, including East Al-Quds, between the River Jordan and the sea, and also Gaza, do not belong to the fake regime of Israel. Indeed, they comprise the components of a viable state of Palestine. For many decades, the imbalance of power that is U.S. support has emboldened successive Israeli regime cabinets to pursue a deliberate policy of expansion of illegal settlements with impunity. This is brazenly contrary to international law and has contributed to the further subjugation of Palestinians. The main manifestation of this creeping annexation is settlements. The word sounds benign, as if it is no more than experimental camping, but the truth is far worse. Settlements may start out as little more than the planting of a caravan, but over the decades, the process has become the full-scale annexation of their neighbor's land. Over half a million Israelis now live in modern-looking towns which are built on stolen land dotted all over the West Bank, thus making a would-be Palestinian state increasingly impractical. The phenomenon is far worse than the mere construction of houses in the wrong place. Settlers are often armed and violent. They displace Palestinians from their own homes, cut down the olive trees on which their livelihood depends, take their scarce water, and frequently subject them to abusive attacks. In turn, the Zionist regime forces known as IDF defend the illegal settlers instead of the indigenous Palestinians they attack. The settlements are served by bespoke roads and utilities, which are either denied to the Palestinians or do not serve their communities. Hand in hand with the settlement movement is the regular forced evictions and demolitions, which see so many Palestinians violently removed from their homes in their own country, all enforced and overseen by the apparatus of the Zionist regime. In East Al-Quds, according to the UN, one-third of all Palestinian homes are liable for demolition. This is why the forced evictions of Sheikh Jarrah is not a real estate issue, but part of a program of getting rid of Palestinians from large areas of East Al-Quds. The baseless claim that the fake regime of Israel is a respected democracy rings hollow when they behave in such an undemocratic way, whereas international law is clear that the West Bank is not theirs. Israelis justify their actions by claiming that the territory is disputed, as if to say that because they want it, their opinion is equal to that of the people whose land they wish to take. It is not. It is this same attitude that has created the serious unrest that has recently erupted. Al-Quds does not belong to the fake regime of Israel. The proposed enforced eviction of over 70 Palestinians from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah has ignited the flames of disorder. This has been simmering for weeks, during which extreme right-wing Israelis have been effectively supported by their police and troops in scenes that should bring the utmost shame to any Israeli. Blocking access to and throwing stun grenades into the Al-Aqsa Mosque is one thing. Beating people up and arresting children is quite another. Last autumn sins of a soldier's knee on a Palestinian's neck should make everyone realize that Palestinian lives matter too. The campaign groups, NGOs, and websites are beginning to multiply in support of human rights, justice, and a fair future for Palestinians. The UK risks being seriously out of tune with the Israeli people. The last few weeks have starkly illustrated that the UK government has been living a lie for years. Its policies, such as it is, exist in a moral vacuum. While stating that the annexation of Palestinian land is in breach of international law and goes against countless UN resolutions, it only ever utters the language of de-escalation. While the scenes in Al-Quds have been clear for all to see, there hasn't been a single word of serious condemnation from the Conservative Friends of Israel, the Labour Friends of Israel, and the Board of Deputies or the government. All have found a way of not doing so. It seems the rules-based order only counts outside the occupied Palestine. The government has a hole in its policy. If it fails to stand for justice, the Conservative Party will forever have a hole in its heart. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. In continuing our discussion on the hadith of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, where he, you know, explains to us, rather doesn't explain to us, he just tells us that this is the traits that occupy, or rather, you know, accompany rather, that person who has aql, and these are the traits that accompany that person who has jahl. So an aql is this, and a jahil is this. So now we've reached the stage where the Imam alayhi salam, according to the text that I have in front of me, is the 17th of this direct conflict. And before I get to it, there's something I would like to remind myself first, and also my dear listeners, that these traits that hopefully, inshallah, we are trying to inculcate within ourselves, is not done with riyah, it's not done for the sake of, you know, people. It is done for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. These traits that indicate or identify an aqil or an intellectual person, very loose translation, is that, you know, it is for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If a person deviates from this intention, then he goes straight into that, you know, quagmire or that group of people who can be classified as being jahil. Hence we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to protect us and our intentions and our sincerity, inshaAllah. So in this segment, the Imam says that that battalion that is for the intellect is what is known as rahbah, fear, deep fear, but not in a negative way, fear of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And again, what we mean by fear, it is not fear that, oh, Allah will punish me. This is one type of fear. Another type of fear could be, am I performing my duties correctly? That is a higher level of fear. Am I, and then even a higher level, is that you fear that you are not fulfilling the potential that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given you. So here we have fear on three different levels, all positive, and none of them are bad. Inshallah, each will lead to the next. And on the other hand, we have what is known as jur'ah. This audacity, this daringness that a person has within him, that I am a creation, but yet I do not see the wants of my Creator. I follow my own whims and I do as I please, but not even focusing and saying, nah, whatever, nothing will happen to me. I can do as I please, I am free. This audacity, this daringness that a person has in front of his Creator. And as the great saint, that sage of the age, Imam al-Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, would say that this world is the viewing ground of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So how can you have that audacity to sin and to do things against your Creator while He is always watching you? We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala again to enable us to truly understand that we are being watched constantly by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I
am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more. No more.